Hi, everyone, and welcome back to a new episode of the Emerging Market Retail Podcast. Today, we have an exciting episode, as usual, where we will be discussing the role of retail innovations in the public social assistance programs, particularly in India, right? And turns out that 90% of low-income and 75% of low- and middle-income countries operate social assistance programs, right? In the case of India, you know, the public distribution system, India spends 7% of its national budget. So it's something huge. And today we are going to delve into this topic on how it works, some of the challenges, and also innovations.
Yeah, and again, this is really a very important topic because we're talking about 160 million households that are impacted by this public assistance program in India alone, that are receiving subsidized food grains at what is called fair price shops, otherwise FPS, which are basically, you know, retail micro businesses or individuals that can allocate some of the space that they have available in order to disperse this assistance. Such assistance is typically provided through these nano stores that serve basically as agents, and those agents typically would serve somewhere between 300 and 400 households.
Yeah, what's really interesting is that traditionally each household had to go to one specific nano source, but in this paper they're investigating portability. So what happens is that households can now choose to which nano store they are going. And basically this paper is investigating a natural experiment. So they launched this initiative in two different states that were originally one state in India. They're investigating how this is impacting the uptake of these social programs. So we have two wonderful guests, Rakesh Alu and Maya Ganesh, and they will tell us all about this.
Very well. Welcome back, listeners. Today, we're diving into an important and often life-saving topic, social assistance programs. So we have two experts today. First, we have Maya Ganesh. She's an assistant professor of operations management at the Indian Institute of Management, Ahmedabad. Her research focuses on public sector operations, socially responsible operations, and food and agricultural supply chains. She's currently working on projects related to the impact of information technology and digitization on the performance of supply chains. Welcome, Maya.
Thank you.
And joining her is Rakesh Alu. He's a PhD candidate in operations technology and information management at the Cornell Johnson College of Business at Cornell University, of course. His research focuses on digital platforms and social sustainability. He uses machine learning and econometric methods to explore how to integrate and manage emerging technologies within these contexts. And some examples include introducing personalized recommendation systems on online B2B platforms, the digitization of small and medium-sized enterprises, user choice enabled by biometric authentication and digital payment systems. So together, they'll help us understand the vital role of social assistance in our communities and the impact these programs have for those in need, right? So let's get started, Simona.
Yes, thank you, Maya and Rakesh, for being with us. So you studied this very important problem of uptake of commodities in social assistance programs. And we were wondering, like, how did you get interested in this very important problem?
Many developing economies, including India, right? So they operate a couple of social assistance programs with a transfer of commodities, like be it food grains or cooking gas or agricultural inputs, etc. Right? But despite this huge budgetary allocations, like for instance, India spends almost 1% of its GDP on its food security program, right? So the beneficiaries still face a bunch of challenges in accessing these entitlements, right? It could be adulteration of commodities or poor service quality, or even denial of their complete entitlement that they are supposed to get by the agents, etc. And so these issues are there at all parts of the supply chain of a welfare benefit program. For instance, what we study, the food India's food security program. But it's more prominent in the last mile, which is where the agents finally disperse the grains to the beneficiaries. Right. So this is because the commission that these agents get when they disperse grains is much lesser compared to if they can instead divert away these grains to, let us say, open markets or black markets. Right. So in some sense, it also accords them this monopoly. Now, a lot of efforts have gone into addressing these issues in the last decade or so. And as many of these interventions are also making use of the newer technology and digitization, etc. So this is where our interest began. So when these efforts were happening, I was a first year PhD student. I had just started at Indian School of Business and Rakesh was a researcher there. And we started reading about these efforts that were going on and what kind of interventions are there, etc. So that's what kind of got us interested. In fact, in the first piece of my thesis, I study one other intervention, which is, so I was telling you about these agents, right, who can actually disperse away grains to the open market. So authentication, so how can we make sure that it goes to the right beneficiary? So there is a biometric authentication device that was also one of the intervention that one of the first interventions that was introduced. And I study that as part of one of my pieces in the thesis. And later there were many other interventions. One other is what we study in this paper, which is giving choice of agent. So this is how our interest in this entire scope of food security program and the changes started. So.
And more
that's broadly, pretty interesting.
Sorry. So more broadly, what's interesting in developing countries and public sector operations is that, so if you look at the standard operating procedures in any government program in a country like India, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, those standard operating procedures are picture perfect. Even academics cannot write better standard operating procedures than those. But the on-ground reality, when you actually go and see how these are executed, is very, very different from what you would find in these operating procedures. So this gap between the design and the execution for us look like there is an OM problem here. There seems to be a beautifully designed system, but the execution is completely away from what that design looks like. So for us, that gap was an OM question. And then we started looking at different angles in which why this design is not getting translated into reality. So that's a broader scope of why we got interested in public sector ops.
Can you give some more examples of the challenges that you saw in your field trips?
Yeah, Maya, do you want to?
Yeah, so I mean, first we read these anecdotes in newspapers, etc., right? But we also made visits both in Karnataka, which is a state in India, and also Andhra Pradesh and Telangana, which is where our study here is based from, right? So we interacted with multiple stakeholders. So with beneficiaries, of course, they were our primary kind of interest. So we spoke to them about like what happens. So they kind of mentioned that, oh, this is what happens when I go to an agent. So the way we will talk about that in detail later. So the way this is designed is that for ease of administration, of course, is that if I am a beneficiary, I am affiliated to a particular agent and I can go and collect my entitlement only from that agent, right? That's how it has been designed traditionally, India's food security program. And that is one of the biggest kind of, that's the source where many of the problems arise. And that's when they told us, they're like, oh, the FPS owner knows that they have this power, which they have called on us. So they're like, they can always say that, oh, I'm not open today, come tomorrow, or you're entitled to 30 kilos, but I'm only giving you 20 kilos. If you want, you take it. Otherwise, I won't even give this to you, right? So these kind of experiences, they told us all about that. They had to like go revisit multiple times. And when they revisit multiple times, these are also the kind of the poorer parts of the society, right? These people. So if they have to go again, which means that they have to miss work, which means they'll be missing out on their daily labor wages, etc., right? So it kind of this effect translates to many other areas as well.
And there's a funny example that we saw. Sorry. Yeah, so there's a funny example that we saw, and it was so the public distribution system is well monitored. So there are officers, government officers, who need to ensure that everybody is getting what they deserve by their right. Right? So monitoring happens. It's a one-off event. It's a random. So an officer can go to a shop and see how the shop is operating on any given day. It's a random event. But the way, I mean, that's the design of how it should work. But the way it actually works on the field is that when an officer is making that visit, he would call at 7 a.m. in the morning that today I'm going to be coming to you. So make sure that I don't see anything that you don't want me to see. So these are some, so when this kind of collusion happens between the shop owner and the government officer, all the things that Maya was saying, you know, there is a scope for all these things to happen, which warrants a very careful study of how these interventions perform. It cannot be just taken at face.
Add to what Rakesh is saying, these inspectors that he's talking about, right? They also, it's kind of manual, and there are very few inspectors. So typically about 50 or 60 such shops or agents are given to one inspector. So in a year, they have to kind of do these audits. So which means every FPS is maybe audited once in a year or once in 2 years, which also makes the problem even more larger. So.
Of course. So thank you for describing that. And I believe that for the audience, it would be nice to also understand what other factors are limiting the access of beneficiaries to their entitlements. And in addition, perhaps you can describe what kind of goods are provided via these social assistance programs.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so goods are typically, so the program that we study is limited to food grains, but there are several, I mean, programs which have a similar modality are executed all over the world. So if you see a lot of countries in Africa, they transfer commodities which are related to healthcare and hygiene, right? So if you see countries like Sri Lanka, Bhutan, Bangladesh, they transfer commodities like fertilizers. Even India still does that, actually. So another example of commodities is LPG gas, right? The liquid petroleum gas. So there are several ways, there are several commodities which are transferred to the beneficiaries by the government. The commodity we study is food grain. So that's the commodity question. And then the second question you had was what are the factors limiting the access?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. So, yeah, what are barriers are there?
Yeah. So I think most of them Maya had already covered. The biggest barrier is that, so the modality is the government ships these commodities to one agent and the beneficiary has to go to that agent, prove their identity, and then collect the commodity. That's the typical operating procedure all over the globe. Now the agent knows that the beneficiary is dependent on my mercy in some sense, because there is no government monitoring, like I just described. Mm-hmm. The government monitoring is weak. So now the agent can completely say, look, I have the power to give you this commodity. I will only give it to you if you do me a personal favor, or I will only give it to you if I feel like. Or I will only give 20% of the commodity to you. 80% is my rent or my rent extraction fee. You know, so all these kinds of all these are examples of ways in which the agent levies power on the beneficiary.
Yeah.
So that's the biggest barrier.
So this monopoly kind of gets manifested in multiple things, like, oh, shop is not open during the time that he or she is supposed to keep it open, denial of entitlements, or like Rakesh said, partial disbursement and keeping the other part for themselves, or even, so these are subsidized, right? So it's mostly like one INR when it or two INR, etc. So sometimes they also overcharge beyond what the subsidized price is. So it manifests in these multiple kind of dimensions.
We've also seen instances where a shop owner would only give the grain to a person of the same caste. Mm. In India, caste is a bit of a big deal.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. Yeah. And we've also seen instances where, in fact, these are written reports where if the beneficiary is a woman, she's being mistreated in certain places. So all these are the ways in which there are access barriers. Yeah.
So could you guys tell us a little bit more about the agents themselves, right? So these are called fair price shops, right? Can you tell us a little bit more about how the registration process works? How do they operate? Do they on the side have maybe a small shop or maybe another type of micro business? Can you tell us a little bit more about the fair price shops themselves?
So Rafa, I mean, most of these are nano retail stores, actually. They are, so their primary business, in most cases, they have a nano retail store and they do this on the side. So that, and the way they end up doing this is, so it's a 3-year contract period from the government. So the government identifies locations where they want to keep a fair price shop. And the government asks people to submit their willingness to operate a fair price shop. And once everybody submits their applications, the government vets them for, you know, crime records and the ability to operate and things like that. And then a license is given for about 2 to 3 years. Right? So in the 2 to 3 years, the primary goal, the primary job of that agent is to go to the nearest warehouse where the rice is stocked, rice or wheat is stocked, obtain, make a purchase, or in fact, make a deposit and obtain the grain from the warehouse to the shop, and authenticate beneficiaries every month and disburse the grain. So, and this, the initial amount of money which the fair price shop owner deposits with the, every month he or she has to deposit a certain amount of money to get the grain. So once all disbursements happen, so that money is reimbursed to the fair price shop by the government. So what's important here is that, so these fair price shop owners are not poor. They have the ability to deposit a working capital in the government, with the government, to get the rice. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that itself makes them socioeconomically superior to the beneficiaries that they're catering to, where the whole power angle comes in.
Yeah, it's great that you clarify that, because when I was reading the paper, I always thought, but this is a really like taxing requirement for the agents themselves, right? I mean, having to finance all of that upfront and then getting reimbursed. I mean, of course, you have the certainty that that is going to be reimbursed. So I guess, that helps. But on the other hand, they have to finance a lot of this operation upfront.
Yes.
So yeah, and that I think contributes to the problem, right? Because it basically creates this imbalanced relationship between the agents and the beneficiaries themselves.
Yeah.
Thank you for describing all these challenging realities. Now we would like to transition into, you know, understanding the specificity of your research question, the problem statement that you guys address. So can you tell us a little bit more about agent choice, which is the specific intervention that you guys investigate in this project?
Like we had earlier mentioned, traditionally, the way India's food security program has been designed is this affiliation, right? This mapping of the beneficiaries to agents. So I'll not talk about it in detail because that's not the focus of this talk, but I just want to mention that agent choice, which is the intervention which we study, is actually enabled because of a previous kind of a technology intervention. I was talking to you about biometric authentication, right? So earlier, even because of ease of administration, it's easier for me to divide up people and say, okay, you belong to this agent, you belong to this agent, this is where you need to collect, right? But this biometric authentication also made the system kind of centralized, because India's Supreme Court kind of passed the law that, oh, the biometric information of every person that is there cannot be locally stored. So it needs to be centrally stored. So every time authentication happens, it has to ping the central server, which also made it easy that every time a beneficiary collects something, everybody knows because it is now there in the central server, right? So this kind of enabled the intervention that we study. So the particular innovation or the intervention that we study is this agent choice, where where state government started saying that, okay, now you need not go to this one particular agent to whom you're affiliated. You can go to anybody in that state, any agent in that particular state, right? So this is the choice that the state governments gave to beneficiaries. Now, though food security is a central subject in India, it's a federal subject. The implementation, all of this is a state subject, right? So state governments had the freedom and flexibility to kind of choose when to start this intervention, when to implement this. This kind of worked in our favor because there was a natural experiment where were these two neighboring states, which were actually one United State much earlier. So one of the states implemented it earlier and the other state implemented it much later. So this gave us a kind of a natural experiment where we could study this agent choice introduction. So what we want is, so the outcome that we look at is uptake itself, right? So in terms of, oh, how much are the beneficiaries now able to get the in terms of grains vis-a-vis before such an innovation or such a agent choice was there earlier.
So diving a little bit deeper in terms of understanding agent choice, how that was received by the different, you know, agents and the beneficiaries themselves, and you also describe, I think, in the paper very thoroughly some of the complexities associated, right? Some of the demand side and some of the supply side challenges. So I was wondering whether you guys could, you know, tell us a little bit about the difficulties in implementing agent choice in India.
So one of the first response was from the agents who simply denied implementing choice. In fact, they went on a huge statewide strike to say that, hey, we are not happy with you implementing choice, which is natural because nobody wants to let go of their power. So that was a huge pushback, which I think over time government resolved in some places by increasing their commission. Like for instance, like what Maya was saying, there is a commission paid to the agent for every kilogram of grain that is dispersed out of his or her shop. So they increased the commission to, in some sense, allay the fear that agents are losing their power or revenue potential. That's one. And the second biggest bottleneck was technology challenges. So it's, in principle, it's fantastic that you can just put your thumbprint and there'll be a central server which will authenticate you and it'll tell you how much grain you're entitled to. In principle, that's fantastic. But rural India, the amount of IT infrastructure that is needed for this authentication to happen on a real-time basis is a big, big challenge. In fact, we even learned, we saw this in the field visits, and we also learned from agents that they did not trust the IT infrastructure themselves for them to implement choice. So the way they would do is, if I know you, I would simply give you the grain if there is, if my authentication machine is not working or if there is no internet connectivity, and I'll authenticate you sometime later. So these kind of flexibilities, which a non-digital system would enable, were not allowed anymore or were not possible anymore with a completely digital system. Yeah.
I was wondering whether, I mean, you could say a few words. You describe in the paper one of the supply side challenges. I mean, of course, in the current or in the traditional implementation, agents, they have a pretty good understanding of what their demand is going to look like, which also allows them to kind of save, reserve the working capital necessary to. And so basically this implementation also seems to introduce some element of uncertainty, at least. Maybe not so much exposed based on your findings, but at least ex ante. I wonder whether that was also an important consideration or an important topic of discussion from agents' perspective.
I mean, that was something which we were curious about. We thought that there would be demand variability now that there is choice. So we thought that, and then we learned from the field that there is no change in the replenishment policy. So the replenishment policy is typically governed by the government. So the government sends a fixed stock of grain to each agent every month. That did not change. And we thought that would be a very serious concern, and that would severely discount the potential impact of choice, ex ante, yes. But yeah. Export, we see that that doesn't really do much damage.
So if you think about it, I mean, intuitively, it's providing choice, right? So it should increase the uptake. So there should be no reason to believe otherwise, right? And what made us, why this became important for us to study is one issue Rakesh mentioned in terms of replenishment policy itself and other operational aspects. For instance, in another piece where we also study portability. Portability is the name that this agent choice was given in India, right? Even the presence of such households, right? Because this is like you're bringing 35 kilograms of grain. So which means that if you walk and go, it would be, the distance would matter, right? So do you even have shops, alternate shops for you to choose from, right? That was also one of the considerations. And in one of our other related study, we find that almost about 25 to 27% of the beneficiaries are in regions where they don't even have an alternate agent within 1 kilometer radius, et cetera. So all of these supply side considerations kind of made us think that, okay, it's not as obvious that because this intervention is there, there would be an increase, and these would potentially limit the benefit that we are thinking we might get.
Okay, fantastic. So now we're, I think, ready to transition into understanding some of the amazing findings that you guys were able to uncover. So can you tell us, you know, briefly summarize some of the key findings that you guys had and some of the mechanisms driving those findings?
Yeah. So key findings, I would say, are three. One is introduction of choice increases uptake of food grain. So what we see is there is a 6.6% increase in overall uptake of food grain at a sub-district month level. Right? Now, that's the first. The second punchline is that most of the 6.6% increase is coming from new beneficiaries trying to access the system. So these people were not able to access the system before introduction of choice for whatever access barriers we discussed at the beginning of the podcast, are now able to access the system. And the third is something which we were very surprised about. We thought that if these people were not able to access the system before, they would use an agent who is not assigned to them to collect the grain. But what we very interestingly found is they go back to use the same agent that they were pre-assigned to collect the grain. So in fact, almost 99.9% of the increase is coming from the person going to the same agent that he or she was assigned to. And we think the potential mechanism of why this is happening is that the introduction of choice acted as a threatening mechanism, in the sense that agents were in some sense threatened that if I don't behave properly or if I don't follow the standard operating procedure, all the beneficiaries who are assigned to me are going to go elsewhere and start collecting grain. And one way in which we see this behavioral, this threatening mechanism manifest is in the number of days the person keeps the shop open. So the standard operating procedure says that about a person has to keep the shop open for the first 15 days of the month. But most agents don't do it. In fact, there is a lot of literature on why agents don't do it. So what we see is after the introduction of choice, agents start keeping their shop open for a longer duration of time. And then they adjust to what the neighboring agent is doing. If the neighboring agent keeps the shop open for 12 days, we see that in the next month, I am more likely to keep the shop open for 13 days. So this kind of dynamic is what we observe in the data. And we think that is the reason why beneficiaries are now able to access their own agents because they are more available to the beneficiary.
Just to add to what Rakesh was saying, so this finding was not just interesting to us, right? This also has kind of more practical implications than what meets the eye. So if, let us say, a new government is worried about implementation costs in terms of the time, effort, and money, it might that it might take to introduce such a choice, right? Because of supply side changes that need to be made, etc. So this can encourage them, because most of the benefits that we see are accrued by enabling more beneficiaries to collect grains from their own pre-assigned agent. So in some sense, a mere announcement of such a policy and not necessarily its usage is encouraging the agents to service better and providing value, right? So this is kind of the practical implication of that.
Yeah, I think this intervention of providing choice to the beneficiaries is a very interesting intervention, and also, well, it looks very promising, right? But also, we were wondering, okay, what are the benefits of providing ensuring more uptake in these in-kind systems instead of simply providing cash to the beneficiaries? What are those benefits? Can you clarify this for us?
I mean, as an operations person, the first benefit that I can think of is, if you say cash, one of the things which you need to do is adjust the amount of cash that you're transferring with inflation, especially in a developing country like India, where inflation is about 6 to 7%. This periodic adjustment needs to be done. So you really need to assign a team of people who is computing this amount of cash that needs to be transferred on an annual basis, number one. And number two, so one of the backgrounds of why in-kind transfer was even is one of the reasons why it is implemented is, so there is a concept called as minimum support price for the farmers. So the government basically promises a minimum support price to the farmer cultivating, let's say, wheat, right? So government purchases the entire wheat at that price, right? So now the government already has the stock of wheat in their godowns and warehouses. So one of the ways to actually channelize that procured product is through these in-kind transfers of commodities. So that's a big background of why in-kind transfers is even it's not just welfare in terms of hunger minimization, but it also has some implications to farmers' crop growth choices and farmer welfare and things like that. So these are the benefits of in-kind transfers in a way. And there has been some criticism to cash transfers in the sense that, so there have been reports which say cash transfers, if you transfer cash, there is a possibility of people misusing the cash in terms of alcohol, tobacco, gambling, etc. In fact, there's an interesting study from South Africa which said that introduction of cash transfer increases money lenders trying to cajole you to take loans, because the money lender knows that you're going to get a government cash transfer and his or her investment in you is safe. So there have been instances like that. And there have also been instances of cash transfers increasing domestic violence. So what some of the governments are doing is they are transferring cash to the woman of the family. And the moment the woman of the family gets financially secure, the man becomes insecure and the man starts domestically abusing the woman. So there have been instances of these subtle nuances of cash transfers have been reported. But the recent empirical literature is saying that on average, if you look at the welfare impact, both cash and in-kind transfer are more or less similar. So I don't know if that's a long-winded answer to your question, but I'm sorry.
Yeah, so which is why I think the which is better, there's still no consensus on whether cash transfers are better. So the way we think about it is that it's a spectrum, right? Which is why food coupons, if you think about it, is which many countries have experimented, is also one way of giving this flexibility where it can only be spent on some designated items, reducing the risk of misuse. So our intervention also, we think of it as somewhere in the spectrum where the choice of where to buy from is there, but there is no choice of what to buy, and it is ensured that it is going towards grains. So, I mean, that's how we think about it.
Very well. I think that brings us to the end of this conversation. We hope you found our discussion enlightening and gained a better understanding of how these programs operate and the critical support that they provide to those in need. A big thank you to our guests, Maya and Rakesh, for sharing their invaluable insights and expertise with us.
Thank you very much for having us. It was a pleasure.
This podcast is brought to you by Tilburg University.